Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Monday, January 31st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, just settling back into the studio after a couple of days on the road. Nice to be here. Obviously, just a tremendous amount of news to talk about. Tried to get one or two guests on what's happening in Egypt right now. And frankly, it's difficult because they're in very high demand. And, you know, a podcast is not the first thing that they're going to do, particularly when, you know, you have an opportunity to go on live television. And, you know, I've been thinking about how to talk about this because it's obviously huge news. And but at the same time, there's really has very little to do with us in many respects. Obviously, America plays some role in this to the extent that it plays a role in events that happen all around the world. Certainly, we were able to make the tear gas canisters that were used there, and that's encouraging for the economy. You know, there's only so much analysis I can give you on this, and I've of course done a tremendous amount of reading. And you know, the one thing that strikes me as fascinating is on this program we had, I guess it was a week ago today. Was it on Monday that we had Juan Cole?
Yep.
Talking about Tunisia. And here's a guy who has written some pretty scholarly work on Egypt. I mean, one of the foremost experts in this country on what is happening in that region in general, and had written a great book on a historical book on Egypt and Napoleon's time there. And just 7 days ago, I guess, what was the date that we had him on? The 25th?
It might have been.
No, the 24th. 1 day later. And I asked him specifically, do you anticipate that what we're seeing here in Tunisia could spread to other places in the Arab world? And he said, specifically, if not unequivocally, no, I don't think so. These regimes have the ability to put down their citizens and have a record of doing it in some respects. And then a day later, very much on the 25th, very much in the way that it started in Tunisia, you had just some protests. And I think by Wednesday they were calling it the Day of Rage against Mubarak. And it has continued unabated. And now it seems like just a matter of time before Mubarak steps down or has to step down or is relieved of his presidency by the military. And, you know, what I have put together here is a little bit of background information and some audio and reports of the latest developments so that you can at least have some context if you are following this story. And I recommend that you do follow it on Twitter. And we have found a great site that has audio dispatches that are being sent out of the country via Twitter. And you remember that we talked about story a couple weeks ago about a guy who had developed Tor, which is this basically this way of backdooring around the web. It gives you an anonymous presence on the web. You can't measure where your IP. And apparently this Tor has been used extensively as Egypt has basically shut down its internet.
I tried to set up a bridge here on Friday for Tor. Wasn't able to. But.
Well, that's probably not something we want to broadcast. One way or the other. But good for you. See that? It is all about us in America. So this is the timeline. On Tuesday, I guess it was Tuesday, protests begin. I don't know if that was the day of rage or it was on Wednesday. By Thursday, Egypt shut down its internet. Now, this is not a Twitter or Facebook revolution, but clearly the ability to have real-time communication and real-time broadcasting to massive amounts of people has changed the dynamic. There are many stories in history of revolutions that may have taken place if people were aware that in one part of the country people were uprising and at the same time other parts of the country were uprising. That has a significant impact. There are countless stories of some uprising in one town that basically just gives up because they don't realize that there are other uprisings happening around the country. And frankly, I don't know that word of Tunisia would have gotten to Egypt in the same way 30 years ago. So it's really less about these entities, Twitter and Facebook, and more about increased ability to communicate and communicate to mass amounts of people. By Saturday, you've got Tor and anonymous internet users helping Egypt to communicate with itself. By Sunday, Al Jazeera in Cairo is being shut down. And I would say probably more than anything else, it was Al Jazeera over those first couple of days that was broadcasting from Cairo. And if you weren't watching the feed, huge mistake. I mean, just fascinating stuff. There's actually an app. You can actually watch it live on your iPhone. On Sunday, Al Jazeera, like I said, in Cairo being shut down. The U.S. Embassy in Cairo urges Americans to leave on Sunday. And then by the Sunday morning talk shows, we're starting to hear something different coming out of U.S. administration officials. And this is important because I think it was on Tuesday or Wednesday, you had the Egyptian military leaders meeting with their counterparts at the Pentagon, just coincidentally, because there is a huge relationship between U.S. and Egyptian military leaders because of all the billions of dollars of arms we've sold them over the years. On Monday, I guess that's today, we have, and they're about 8 hours ahead of us, maybe a little more. You have Mubarak attempting to put in a new government, and we will talk about his new vice president, this guy Suleiman. Who does have, well, I mean, we get a sense of just how brutal he is based upon the work that we've basically contracted to him over the years. So let me take you through some of these pieces here. You know, like I say, I don't have a tremendous amount of commentary to add to this, but if you have not been following the story or haven't had the time, that's what I'm here for. That's my job. That's what some of you pay me for. More of you could if you became members at majority.fm, and many of you have been buying coffee and chocolate and supporting our sole sponsor right now. JustCoffee.coop, put in majority, get 10% discount. How do you like that for a segue? I've been listening to a lot of Sean Hannity. Oh, you can't talk, can you, Dorsey? He doesn't have a microphone. And you can talk, Adam. Why are you signaling? Why are you?
I think you still have the Dorsey's microphone sand in your bag from D.C.
Ah. Okay, fair enough. So Heather Hurlburt, she is the executive director of the National Security Network. She had a couple of dispatches, and this was from the beginning of the weekend. And she reiterates that very few people had, that no one really had a sense of that this was going to happen. She had spoke to a member of the House Intelligence Committee whether they had ever even been briefed that such a thing was possible in Egypt. You understand that there has been nothing like this in Egypt in 30 years, and because there was a very repressive police force that would be more equivalent to like almost a paramilitary organization. And I think there were some WikiLeaks cables that even came out that suggested that there was no real concern about this because Egyptians were more concerned about their daily lives than freedom.
Yeah, and even 30 years ago, it was sparked by an assassination by an outside force.
Right. That was not a revolution in any sense.
Right.
There was actually Mubarak was the VP at that time. And then Mubarak got rid of the vice president. And she says, watch the military. There are institutions in Egypt. They will ultimately, though perhaps not today, make the decisive difference. And I think this is, from everything I've read, is absolutely correct. The military, she writes, has not been deployed in Cairo since 1986. That has changed. The military has been deployed. It has never fired on Egyptian civilians. Now, understand now. The military is so closely aligned with the United States military. So many of their salaries is ultimately paid by us that this is going to be a decisive factor, I believe. We give them $2 billion a year in aid, and it essentially all goes to either weapons or paying the military. That's not counting the slush funds that, you know, I have a feeling when these generals show up at the Pentagon, they have a very, very nice lunch waiting for them. And as far as the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been the sort of longstanding opposition to the Mubarak regime, so much so that it's been outlawed, and it has something like 14 or 20 friendly members in the parliament, which I think the parliament is more or less a joke, but they cannot identify themselves as Muslim Brotherhood, but they seem to be very aligned. And Muslim Brotherhood renounced violence over 30 years ago. It has been widely reported that the Muslim Brotherhood didn't even participate in the organization of this revolution. That they came to it very late, that they were very sensitive to the idea that, I guess, the secular Egyptians are very nervous about the Muslim Brotherhood, and they have been in many ways vilified as a way for Mubarak to blame internal strife on them. And so they were very, very, they've been very low key. And just about all the reports you hear, it seems to be secularists. That this seems to be much more about money and income disparity in Egypt. And also, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a so-called Islamist organization, has been for decades the number one enemy of Al-Qaeda. Because they apparently have been more focused on political and individual governments change than some type of large-scale sort of East versus West fight. And that's been annoying, I guess, to Al-Qaeda. So that's just, one One dispatch. The New York Times also has been pursuing this story yesterday that this is very much about a rift between the rich and the poor. Most of this is anecdotal, but one guy on the ground, Muhammad Abraham, a 24-year-old textile worker standing at his second job as a fruit peddler in a hard-pressed neighborhood called Dar al-Salaam. If they were giving us our rights, why would we protest? People are desperate. He had little sympathy for those frightened by the specter of looting. And now much of the looting, I should say, has been reported. You know, one, I'm just telling you the reports I've heard. That there is widespread belief that the looters have been predominantly Secret Service members of the police as a way of scaring people, particularly the upper middle class, I would imagine, into believing that this is going to be chaos, that the upper and middle classes are going to suffer if there is some type of regime change, and it seems to be ineffective. He complained that he could barely afford rent, and the police routinely humiliated him by shaking him down for money, overturning his cart, or stealing his fruit. Very reminiscent of what we heard in Tunisia. I mean, that is the supposed catalyst, that like an event exactly like that. And then we hear about how these big guys have all these new boats and 100,000-pound villas. They are building housing, but not for us, for these people up high. The widening chasm between rich and poor, the New York Times reports, in Cairo has been one of the conspicuous aspects of city life over the last decade, and especially the last 5 years. Until recently, the rich lived more or less among the poor, in grander apartments or more spacious apartments, but mixed together in the same city. As the Mubarak administration has taken steps towards privatizing more government businesses, kicking off an economic boom for some, rich Egyptians have fled the city. They have flocked to gated communities full of big American-style homes around the country clubs, and the remoteness of their lives from those average Egyptians has become starkly visible. Sitting Behind Dorsey, I believe, is a book called Collapse by Jared Diamond. I reference it often, and the basic premise is that when the rich in a society close themselves off, literally and metaphorically, in gated communities, they lose touch with what is going on amongst their people, and that is when societies collapse. Interesting anecdote from the ground in Egypt. A.J. Rossmiller, in an email that I was privy to, also worth mentioning that it's highly unusual. And A.J. Rossmiller, you remember, was an intelligence officer in Iraq and has studied stuff like this and has worked with people who have studied things like this. And he says there's a chance there's going to be another, there is another aspect that there is basically models for how these things go. And in Iran, we saw how one way these things go, where at the moment first of any unrest, the regime is incredibly brutal, cracks down, and just completely quashes it. This Mubarak let things go too long for his fortunes, and now it could get ugly because it's going to come down to whether or not the military sides with the people or with Mubarak. And my sense is it's just gone too far, and they will side with the people. And when they get the order that you must crush the protesters, they will then go and take out Mubarak. But he said, Rossmiller says, it's also worth mentioning that it's highly unusual for an uprising to both begin in the heart of state power and be mostly unarmed. In Tunisia, the uprising apparently came from poor areas, rural areas, and then went urban. In Egypt, it appears to be the opposite. Now, you've got reports that, like, it started in Cairo, and then it spread to, like, Alexandria and other cities around the country and towns. As Michael Hanna has noted, nobody seems to have any idea what's happening outside of Cairo, Alexandria, and Suez. That's odd. So is the organization and success of the protesters, despite having no means of coercion. In other words, in a place like Cairo, you know, like I know that in Havana, Fidel Castro brings in his military, his police force is brought in from the country because he wants the peasants, essentially, with their resent of city dwellers, to function as his eyes and ears, to quell any revolt that would happen in Havana. Now, understand the dynamics are different here, because in Havana, you have people who are more inclined to want a less socialist regime. These are, you know, sort of the people who have the money and are not necessarily protected by Castro. Castro's power base is in the rural areas. In Egypt, you have almost the opposite. In Cairo, you have a lot of wealthy and upper middle class who would be worried if their shops are going to be looted, theoretically, would be worried that their ability to have money would be threatened by some type of uprising. And as such, the point that Ross Miller is making here is that without them being armed, there really is no reason why one would expect that they wouldn't be overrun by the cops. Would they call for security, which, you know, that's why rich people are so concerned about property rights in general, because they have a lot of property to lose. And it didn't happen here, so it's strange. So that there is some conjecture here that this is coming from not just protesters on the street, but there are some institutional supports that may be working things behind the scenes.
I'm looking at an article right now from The National, which is a newspaper out in Abu Dhabi, and it's an English language paper, and there's just this thing right here that says, in surreal scenes, soldiers stood by tanks covered in anti-Mubarak graffiti. Asked how they could let protesters scroll anti-Mubarak slogans on their vehicles, one soldier said, quote, these are written by the people. It's the views of the people.
Right. I mean, and it could very well be that the military, you know, it. When I first saw the reports that the Egyptians were at the Pentagon, I was like, that's quite a coincidence. But apparently they're there quite often. But even if it was just a coincidence, they're in the room as this is starting, right? I mean, they're sitting with their American counterparts as this is starting. And I would imagine it's like, here, do you guys want the poached salmon or do you want the rack of lamb? Here, have the rack of lamb. And listen, let's be very careful with what happens here. Let's just be very careful. And if there was an understanding that the military was not going to move to the next step, it may have emboldened certain sections. This is all speculation on my part. But those images of people like taking those police vehicles and, you know, torching them and dumping them, trying to dump them in the river, it was pretty amazing. So meanwhile, you've got El-Baradei, who we know, you know, many of us know Mohammed El-Baradei as the weapons inspector who was from the UN Atomic Regulatory Commission, I guess, who did a lot of work in Iran. He had headed to, I guess, Egypt on Thursday or Friday. And he's a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. He's been an Egyptian activist. From everything I've read, there is a little bit of resent that he hasn't been in Egypt all these years. But he apparently is emerging as the leader of these different opposition groups. He has been quite unequivocal about saying that the Muslim Brotherhood is not an extremist organization, that they're an important opposition group. And we will update that in a minute when I move, when I transition, to give you just a little more background into just what I'm reading about in the past 4 or 5 hours. Now, I did mention that Mubarak appointed his first vice president in, I guess, about 30 years. And it was a guy named Omar Suleiman. Jane Mayer has written extensively about Omar Suleiman. Many people have. Omar Suleiman, you'll remember that we went to, we invaded and occupied Iraq illegally because we had absolute knowledge that they had a nuclear weapons program, that Al-Qaeda was involved with Saddam Hussein, that they posed an imminent threat to us. Well, the connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden was developed through the torturing of a guy named Al-Labi. In fact, Al-Labi was, I think, Osama bin Laden's driver or some such. And we got him in Afghanistan. He was being interrogated with the FBI. The CIA came in, got jurisdiction from Bush. They renditioned him to Egypt because we knew that we had a guy there who would torture him, and that was Omar Suleiman. He was in charge of all rendition, according to Jane Mayer, who wrote one of the definitive books, and as written by Stephen Gray in The Ghost Plane, every rendition was greenlighted at the highest levels of both the U.S. and Egyptian intelligence agencies. Edward Walker, Jr., former U.S. ambassador to Egypt, described Suleiman as very bright, very realistic, adding that he was cognizant that there was a downside to some of the negative things that the Egyptians were engaged in, of torture and so on. But he was not squeamish, by the way. So he was like their primary torturer. And it seems that Egyptians are quite aware of that. Strange guy to put in as your VP. Because you got to think, you know, he's not just torturing the people that America brings him. That would be inefficient. You open up a torture shop, you're going to torture your own people too. Spencer Ackerman talks about American weapons on Cairo's streets. Al Jazeera showed an M1A1 Abrams tank carrying Egyptian soldiers through Cairo. These tanks have been co-produced in Egypt since 1988. Egyptians have about 1,000 of them. Canisters containing tear gas, as he says, have been retweeted, stamped with Made in America on them. On Sunday, jets flew over a Cairo crowd, turning on their afterburners to deafen their audience, most likely part of Egypt's fleet of 220 F-16s. Most of the $1.3 billion that the U.S. annually provides to Egypt in military aid goes for weaponry to defend Egypt against foreign assault, like Patriot air defense missiles, multiple launch rocket systems, and TOW anti-armor missiles. But it does speak to how close the U.S. and Egyptian militaries are. Much of Egypt's officer corps gets educated in American war colleges. Every other year, Egypt hosts a huge multinational military exercise directed by U.S. Central Command called Bright Star. That's nice. All this is a peace dividend as part of the 1977 Camp David Accords that forged the durable Egyptian-Israeli peace. Egypt became the U.S. second largest arms purchaser. When protests exploded on Friday, Egypt's chief of staff, Lieutenant General Sami Hafas Annan, was at the Pentagon. for an annual U.S.-Egyptian parley. I think he was there earlier, I read. U.S. defense officials urged them to exercise restraint on the protesters, but the army thus far has appeared to exhibit that on its own. Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, I imagine if I was the Egyptian army, I would not want to say, oh, we're listening to Americans. And some suggest that the show of force with the army coming out there with the tanks is as much to show Mubarak as it is the people who is in charge here and what will and will not be tolerated. So that catches us up to last night, a piece from Sharif Kudus, who I believe is a Democracy Now! Correspondent. See, folks, we don't have the ability to do that. Understand that Democracy Now!'s budget is, let's see, 10 times 100. Literally, I think $1,000 more.
A thousand times more.
Yeah, no, it's a little more than $1,000 more. 1,000 times more than ours. And that's actually could be a conservative estimate.
Yeah.
They're quite well-funded organization.
I would gladly be our foreign correspondent.
There you go, man. I can get you up to Maine, I think. I think. Depends on how well your car is running. He reports from Sunday, in the second day of defiance of military curfew, more than 150,000 protesters packed into Hayer Square on Sunday. My understanding is that now there are over 250,000. Military tanks stationed at entrance points around the squares, with soldiers forming barricades across the street and alleyways. People quickly formed orderly queues to get through the army checkpoints. Soldiers frisked people and checked their ID cards. One soldier said they were making sure no one with police or state security credentials could enter. So that's an indication of two things. One, just how peaceful these protests have become. Nobody's carrying any type of weapons into that is a terrifying prospect. And the other is that they're supposedly checking for security IDs. In other words, keeping the police force out. Now, this cuts two ways. One, it could be very helpful in the sense that the military is clearly aware that these people would cause problems and we're going to keep them out of there. And then the other paranoid part of me thinks this is a story so that if problems do arise in there that are caused by these people, the implication is that none of these people were in there. But I doubt it. I mean, this is the military checking everybody. So let my paranoia recede. He goes on to say reports are widespread that many looters in Cairo are in fact remnants of the police and state security forces. Never before during Mubarak's reign have so many gathered in one popular protest as Tahrir Square. Mubarak's attempts to placate the mass uprising by appointing to two high positions two of his top party officials, Omar Suleiman, the country's infamous intelligence chief, and his vice president, and Ammar Shafiq, former Air Force commander as prime minister, have been met with strong opposition amongst the protesters. He goes on to write, Mohammed El-Baradei, the Nobel Peace Laureate and former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, arrived in Tahrir Square today to address the crowds. Baradei's reputation is beyond reproach, and he commands respect amongst most Egyptians, but many say he has lived outside the countries too long and criticize him for not taking part in earlier street protests. Professor Juan Cole reports today at his blog at Informed Comment at juancole.com, protesters in downtown Cairo on Monday morning, we're calling for a general strike. On Tuesday, they will launch a million-person march, clearly with the aim of toppling Mubarak government. This is, I think, going to be the push. This is going to be it, I think, tomorrow. And tomorrow is actually in about 10 hours from now.
About that, yeah.
On Sunday, multi-party coalition of oppositionists have formed a 10-man committee to head their movement. The leader of the committee is Mohammed al-Baradei. Among the proposed steering committee is longtime Mubarak opponent Ayman Nur. He had run against Mubarak in 2005. He was promptly jailed when the official statistics showed he only had 8% of the vote. He had earlier proposed that the major opposition parties form an alternative parliament, which could then oversee the transition to full democracy. Al-Baradei now seems to be endorsing that idea. So that is what is being reported as of this morning. And this morning, six Al Jazeera reporters were essentially detained for about 3 hours. They were released after the U.S. government demanded their release. So that's a good sign that the Obama administration has a sense of where they should be on this. They have been very quiet or very measured. And frankly, I don't see what else they could have done. It's really, at the end of the day, none of their business. And publicly, you just don't, other than strutting, is it valuable to the people on the ground if the Americans are if the American government supports them? I don't think so. What is more important, which we will never know, is what are military U.S. military officials saying to Egyptian military officials? What is the U.S. government doing behind the scenes? That's more important. And to see them interceding in this Al Jazeera situation is good. And today they have changed their tone. As of this morning, Obama issued a statement this morning saying that he supports an orderly transition to a government that is responsive to the aspirations of Egyptian people. Which is very similar to what has been said by Clinton on Sunday. So they are moving towards saying that there should be a transition. It should be orderly. And who knows what they're saying to the military, who would definitely be the people who would be midwifing such a transition. Over the weekend, according to Jake Tapper, Defense Secretary Robert Gates spoke with Field Marshal Tantawi, the Egyptian Minister of Defense, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen spoke to his Egyptian counterpart, Lieutenant General Sami Inan. So, you know, look, we pay these guys' salaries. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I imagine that the U.S. government knows that we're beyond the point of return here. So I would be surprised that if we don't see Mubarak just step down, that we don't see one of those two guys, Field Marshal Tantawi or Lieutenant General Sami Inan, walk into Mubarak's house or his palace or wherever, his presidential suite, and say, okay, Chief, you want a plane? You want to take a plane out of here? We're going to drive you there. I mean, I imagine they would not say that in that exact vernacular. As of 8:10 this morning, Sultan al-Qassami, who I've been following on Twitter, says that Al Jazeera reports that more than 250,000 protesters in Meydan Tahrir, that's essentially Liberation Square, Tahrir Square, in central Cairo. And Jeremy Scahill reminds us that under Bush, U.S. bombed Al Jazeera's offices. Today, Obama administration calls on Egypt to free its detained journalists. It had an impact. I got three pieces of audio. One is just how fucked up things were during the Bush administration. Here is Frances Townsend. She was like a... She was in Homeland Security. I think she was like number two there or something, but she's like this right-wing sort of, you know, pundit who's on CNN, of course. You know, confused she gets about how many people we've tortured. She's in a conversation with Mona Ella Tahawi, who is a an Egyptian activist. I think she's in Britain now.
I think so, yeah.
And she's talking about Suleiman and saying this guy is a torturer. And then Fran Townsend confuses her torture victims. It's okay, let's play this.
When Hosni Mubarak addressed the nation yesterday and said, I'm going to fire my government, he got it all wrong. He got it back to front. They want him to fire himself. The protesters in Tahrir Square, Liberation Square in downtown Cairo, are chanting now against Mubarak and Omar Suleiman. Omar, you know, Egypt is the number one destination for rendition. Omar Suleiman has been responsible for torturing terrorism suspects for the U.S. administration. Everybody in Egypt knows this, and they associate Omar Suleiman and Hosni Mubarak with torture and with filling up Egyptian jails and human rights violations. Egyptians want the entire Mubarak regime gone in the way that Tunisians want the entire Ben Ali regime gone, and they're doing it, and we are learning from the Tunisians, and I'm optimistic that they'll do it in Egypt.
During the Bush administration, were there renditions to Egypt and to Omar Suleiman, who was in charge of the intelligence community? Is she right, in other words?
Well, the one that's best known is the one where the individual was taken to Canada. Canada then returned him. And there was much litigation about it, and there was litigation about his treatment when he
was
there.
But that was in Syria, wasn't it?
You know, you're right, Wolf. I'm sorry. Yeah. That one was to Syria. Look, there's a long history of renditions. You are quite correct. Between the United States and Egypt, I'm sorry. And look, because of the State Department Human Rights Report, there were procedures put in place to try and protect anyone who was returned from Egypt from suffering from the kinds of human rights abuses.
Mona, one final.
Can you believe that? I'm sorry. I got the wrong torture victim. Yeah. We tortured so many people. She was talking about that Canadian citizen, that guy Marar, who was completely just total mistaken case of mistaken identity. Picked up by U.S. officials upon coming, or handed over from Canada, and then shipped to Syria in some company's jet, you know, the CIA had somebody's private jet that wasn't going to the Super Bowl, I guess, was just taking somebody to Syria to be tortured. U.S. government has not apologized for that, incidentally. What are you going to do? And, but yes, we sent so many people to Egypt to be tortured. I mean, it's, so that Suleiman's not going to help. Now we have two dispatches. This is a great, what's happening now is that people are uploading some audio dispatches to Twitter. And we'll put that link on the blog. And Dorsey will tweet it out on our Twitter feed. This first one is from a guy named Ali. He's a 24-year-old social researcher. He is in Tahrir Square. This is coming from just probably an hour and a half ago. Maybe less, actually. About an hour. The second one, anyways. All right, so let's play the first one. A little bit hard to hear, but just fascinating to hear this.
This is Ali. I'm a 24-year-old social researcher, graduated from anthropology. I'm sitting right now in Tahrir Square, where there are people who are. I just got space passed around to me. People are coming in by the thousands still, even though it's officially 4:07 here in Cairo, and the national curfew yesterday was extended from 3. More mobilizations today of people walking around. Yesterday, small groups of people in the thousands, but not marching together. Today, you have people who are in the thousands marching together, united under slogans. Banners that say things like "Go out, Mubarak," to ones that are lighter and tone, to ones that are asking for the Minister of Interior and Mubarak to go through a prosecution to make sure that when we turn the leaf here, that it's turned when people can actually find their grievances met. The best way people are focusing on it is through legal amendments, and you can see that in the banners that are going around. I'm walking down the street right now, people with sound systems, and they're still going with the same slogans, out for Mubarak and Muhakma, which is prosecution. And on another note, other people in the street, everybody feels like they want to do something, so you have people who are collecting garbage still around. You have tons of food being distributed. Dates have become the common staple now, as well as kosher, which is the biggest Egyptian staple food.
So fascinating. Now, 4:07 in Egypt is what time here?
I'm looking that up.
And, you know, there has been a lot of reports that there is sort of like that reports of all of these people in Cairo going around and cleaning up the city simultaneously as almost as like a sort of another form of defiance saying that, you know, we care about Egypt. We just want Mubarak out.
And that was about 3 hours ago.
Okay, so that report was from 3 hours ago. And here is another dispatch from the same guy, right?
Yeah.
And we will put a link up on the majority.fm, and we will tweet out a link to where you can just follow these dispatches because it's difficult to get any type of audio, and it's this is interesting. Okay, it's number two.
I'm on Kopi Gedet right now, Gedet Bridge. I have plastic bags in my hand and a broom in my left hand, and I'm good. I'm walking to Tahrir Square. The police are down today, but they're just the traffic police, not the ones that handle demonstrations. And we are, when we pass by them, we make sure that they know we welcome them and say good morning to them and everything. And right now there's like 20 people on Gedet Bridge who have come out with brooms and plastic bags, and they're just cleaning. On Gedet Bridge, two police trucks had been left by the police earlier on Friday. They had disconnected their batteries and threw them into the Nile and left their trucks. But there was a lot of, like, rubble around them. So right now people are just there cleaning up that rubble. Showing basically that, you know, if Mubarak says that we can't take orders into our own hands and soon enough we'll starve out and we'll ask for our government back, it's not true. We're taking orders into our own hands. And the way that he's doing it is definitely not short-circuiting any of these demonstrations. In fact, because 30 years of corruption has just fueled it on for the people. Just by the way he takes the decision, every day the people can get at Tahrir Square and they stay. They make certain demands, they create certain things, and he just keeps saying, well, I'll change the players of the game. How about I change this? How about I do that? He doesn't get it. He just won't get it until he's obviously out of power.
So there you did. There you have it. I mean, that is all the news that I have for you on Egypt. And we'll go another 10 minutes, and then we'll do the post-show, and I'll take your calls. We'll do an extended version today as we get into domestic news. Over the weekend, speaking of another repressive regime, gosh, I'll tell you, it'd be nice if this spirit of a revolution was to hit this country. We may have to wait for things to get a little bit worse here. But you wonder why they put through something like the Health Care Reform Act. It's just let a little bit of air out of the tires, folks. That's the idea there. I mean, who knows how this is going to work out in Egypt? But thousands converge on the Koch brothers' billionaires caucus. 25 were arrested. David Dayan was there in Rancho Mirage, California, on Sunday. 25 protesters were arrested in front of the Rancho Los Palmas Resort, site of the Billionaires Caucus, an annual meeting put on by the Koch brothers and other corporate entities and conservative movement operators. Protest organizers included California Courage Campaign, Credo, Move On, 350.org, the California Nurses Association, United Domestic Workers of America, and Common Cause. The police, who wore riot gear, batons, and helmets, put the arrested into plastic handcuffs. There you go.
Great.
There were estimates of 800 to 1,000 activists at the Uncloak the Kochs event. According to Dayan, it appeared from the ground that well over 1,000 protesters were there. Van Jones, former Green Jobs deputy in the Obama administration, said that it was a little bit unusual for Common Cause, which is considered a laid-back, more congenial organization, to be part of such an action. And Van Jones said, I think you're going to see a new Common Cause. As you know, the Koch brothers fund probably just about every right-wing organization there is in some fashion or another. Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, Americans for Prosperity. I imagine they give money to Hillsdale College, or the Heritage Foundation does. This is they are one of the prime sponsors of Wingnut Welfare. Listen to Sean Hannity program or Glenn Beck program or Rush Limbaugh program. There are ads from entities that the Koch brothers fund, period. They fund everything. And, you know, their dollar has that multiplier effect. We talked about this, right? I mean, give money to the Heritage Foundation, which pays for a bunch of right-wingers who then can go on to the shows, which pays to sponsor the shows. And apparently Andrew Breitbart was riding around in shorts and roller skates. And had a couple of his lackeys with him. Dan asked Breitbart exactly who necessitated the riot police. He claimed he had seen unspecified internal emails proving the potential for violence and the need for security. Breitbart keeping security with shorts and roller skates. What a lunatic that guy is. And, of course, the New York Times poo-poos the protesters as being overblown about nothing. This is a wonderful story. Oh, I got to get to this Ayn Rand story. H.R. 3. New law for the Republican Congress. Also co-sponsored by one or two anti-choice Democrats. H.R. 3, known as the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act, would make permanent the Hyde Amendment, which bans federal funding of abortion in all cases. It would eliminate employer and individual tax deductions for private insurance plans that cover abortion. So essentially, your employer's health insurance, if it covers abortion, would then be raised for everybody. Basically, it would be a tax increase for healthcare plans that provide a legal medical procedure. And one that obviously has great implications in terms of health. And then, even more wonderfully, it redefines what the government considers rape. Currently, women insured under Medicare or Medicaid through the government can obtain abortions in cases of rape, incest, or risk to the life or health of the mother. Under the new law, the only rapes that would qualify a woman for abortion coverage would be so-called, quote-unquote, forcible rape. Statutory rape, incest, and other kinds of reputedly nonviolent sexual assaults, for example, assault when a rapist used drugs to incapacitate the victim, might not count as forcible. They wouldn't be classified as rape for the purposes of obtaining abortion coverage. You understand? So, in other words, if a father rapes his daughter, but is not forcible about it, abortion wouldn't be considered rape in terms of obtaining an abortion. If somebody gives a woman a drug that knocks her out or gets her drunk, that would not be rape. If a 25-year-old has sex with a willing 16-year-old girl or 15-year-old girl, she gets pregnant, that would not be considered rape for the purposes of this. Shocking. And this guy, Dan Lipinski, is a handful of Democratic co-sponsors of H.R. 3. He apparently is going to be checking on that language. Good for him. And finally, folks, this story is wonderful. And I guess it's been out there for a while, but it's made a comeback because I think it's been confirmed. Ayn Rand. She is the probably the godmother of the sort of modern libertarian movement. Her book, Atlas Shrugged, is the Bible for all these people who say that if taxes are raised, I'm going to go Galt, which is a reference to the lead, John Galt, who took an oath. I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man. In other words, I'm not going to pay taxes to support somebody else with their Medicare and their Social Security and their welfare and their
fire departments,
nor ask another man to live for mine. That's when you hear people say, like, if you raise taxes too much on rich men, they'll just go Galt, which means they won't make any more money at all. They're not going to go make money because they don't want it to go into the coffers, because that's what it's about. This isn't just simply about principle for people like Ayn Rand or Ayn Rand. It's not about principle. I mean, it's not about policy. It's not about they think like taxes are bad and it makes you a blood-sucking leech where you live off the government. Well, it turns out Ayn Rand was a heavy smoker who believed that all the warnings about tobacco was just one more aspect of government hype and intervention, not unlike global warming. Sadly, Ms. Rand was a fatal victim of lung cancer. It was revealed in the recent oral history of Ayn Rand by Scott McConnell, founder of the media department at Ayn Rand Institute, that in an interview with Ava Pryor, a social worker and consultant to Ms. Rand's law firm of Ernst, Kane, Gitlin, and Vinnick, verified that on Ms. Rand's behalf, she secured Rand's Social Security and Medicare payments, which Ayn received under the name of Ann O'Connor. Pryor said, quote, doctors cost a lot more money than books earn, and she could be totally wiped out without the aid of these two government programs. Ayn took the bail out, even though Ayn despised government interference and felt that people should live and could live independently. She didn't feel that an individual should take help. Is this the pinnacle of hypocrisy? Remember, this isn't just a case of what she thought government policy should be. And then it would be silly for not to her to avail herself of this policy that she was not able to change. This is her saying that individuals are blood-sucking leeches if they take this. That you are less of a human being. That social insurance from the state, taking it, is immoral because its benefits are stolen by parasites, being tax leviers and loafers from the hardworking and morally pure producers. Her philosophy of objectivism says that one is not permitted to do things for other people out of some sense of moral obligation.
I think it's a little generous to call that a philosophy.
Well, that's what it is. And at the same token, taking this stuff is also completely contrary to her objectivist philosophy, which simply goes to what I have been saying for a long time. And that is, it's very easy to call yourself a libertarian because you always get to draw the line wherever you want it. In Ayn Rand's case, Ayn Rand, or whatever she wants to call herself, she drew that line. You are a scumbag if you take government help unless it's Medicare and Social Security for me. and my lung cancer. And then everything else on the other side of that line, that's bad. Stick around. I'll take your IMs on the other side at Majority FM. If you want to know how to IM me, we have a link on the blog, don't we? Or it's on majorityreportrecap.tumblr, but we'll bring a link onto the blog for that. All right, folks. See you on the other side. Please become a member, please. One of these days, I'm going to beg. We're a little bit behind our numbers. All right, we'll talk to you. All right, we are back. You can IM me at Majority FM. Wow, very few IMers today, folks. So I will get to all of it. We got virtually none. Any thoughts on why... good morning, Nefertiti. Any thoughts on why Al Jazeera English is not available on U.S. cable TV? Prior to now, there was just not much of a demand for it, my guess. I don't know. I don't think there was anything nefarious. I think you're going to see a lot more cable companies covering it now. But you know what? Screw it. Let's get it on Netflix. I got my Netflix Roku set up, and it has an app for Justin TV. So I can watch live news on that. It has this Hulu Extra, but for some reason I don't get good reception on the Hulu Extra. It gives me these weird mores. Like, you know, YouTube I get bad, but it's because of the quality of the video. But my Netflix streaming is fine. I could be done with cable. The only thing that's nice about cable is that the live stuff is DVR'd, where you cannot do that. And how would I get Mad Men? I guess on iTunes, but then I got to get Apple TV. But I guess if you have Apple TV and Roku, why not? It's $200. And no cable. And then you got to buy a couple extra things, and all of a sudden you're back up. Hello, Harold. War on the poor. What significance do you think the revolution in Egypt might have on Israel's blockade on Gaza? You know, I have no idea. I mean, it's, you know, I can tell you that the experts were saying that what happened in Tunisia was not going to affect Egypt. And I am not an expert. So I don't know. You know, I have no sense. We'll try and get some people on to talk about it. But I don't know that the experts know anything. It's going to be interesting to see. And now there's like some talk. There's a couple of people on a hunger strike in Libya. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. And of course, the right wing is now saying this is all because of George Bush's invasion of Iraq. Whereas they're not saying anything about the speech that Obama gave to the Egyptians that they all criticized him for, right? It's too right. Soft and mushy. I don't know if I heard one report where somebody was saying that bloggers are so held in such esteem in Egypt that, like, if you get into a cab and you start talking and they find out you're a blogger, they'll give you, like, free cab rides. Weird stuff like that. I mean, you know, there's obviously something was brewing there. And, you know, one of the things that is becoming increasingly clear over the past couple of months is that there's stuff that's happening in these digital networks that I think escape the analysis of establishment people. I mean, I remember, you know, I was fairly involved in at least tracking politics. And in 99, was it the WTO in 99 in Seattle?
Yeah.
I had no idea. I hadn't heard anything about those protests prior to them happening. But clearly 40,000 people had heard about it. And it was all online. I mean, it must have been through, like, you know, primitive bulletin boards and email lists. And, you know, when you see a guy, I can't remember his name now, this guy who invented Tor. This is the same guy who comes into this country, has his computer taken, has his phones taken, so much so that he now no longer carries them into the country with him. And he just has these encrypted drives that say, that have the civil, you know, the First Amendment written on, or the Bill of Rights. This same guy, what he has developed is being used by Egyptians to access the internet, whether it's to stream Al Jazeera, to get tweets from Al Jazeera, to coordinate with other Egyptian protesters. This is like, it's not, you know, you can't brand it in the same way. It's really more about networks than it is any given app. But there's something happening that, you know, the same thing that sort of created an internet, you know, a blogosphere in this country, as more and more people have access to these tools, and they don't, they're no longer just a function of rich people having them, and they become, you know, just extremely efficient, equivalent to, you know, a shofar, frankly, or drums. You know, that's what the shofar used to be for. Everybody gets to the top of the mountaintop, you know, three toots, and then, you know, someone miles away gets another three toots, pass it on. It's just that it's far more efficient now. And, you know, there was some manual going around, I think it was like mid last week, right? PDF on like where to meet, what to do. This type of shit was just impossible years ago. And now you can have it on your phone, and it's on the go, and there's something clearly happening.
I think it was the RNC convention in New York City. It was the first time that I was aware of people using text messages to tell people where the police were cracking down on protests,
right,
and where they weren't.
Right. I'll warn the poor, because Egypt is maintaining a blockade from the south. Oh, I believe, haven't the soldiers left that post? I'm not sure about that. I have a couple of Netflix recommendations for you, both music docs, Heavy Metal in Baghdad. Send them to majorityreporters@gmail.com, please. Harold, hi, Sam. David, please post the Ayn Rand story on the blog or Twitter. Will do. Hry Popville, this might sound stupid, but then we're talking about Boner. Did you see the House using the debt ceiling to pass reduce access to abortions and health care? You know, Seattle News did cover it after the fact when they fired the police chief, WTO 99. You know, I'll tell you something. It's not inconceivable to me that the Republicans would want to use the debt ceiling to limit the abortion in health care, but that would be a grave mistake, because then they are conflating social conservatism with their supposed fiscal conservatism, and that would be such a perfect way for the media to begin to essentially attack the false premise that somehow these people are financially responsible. So I would expect not to see that. Hey, Sam. Hi, Johnny. Live from Singapore. It's 1:30 a.m. Is it a sign that I should take a break from the Majority Report after recently having had a dream when I got into an argument with John Benjamin and called him a bald asshole? No offense to Mr. Benjamin, but in the dream he was being a jerk. I could tell you this, I, Johnny, right now. That I would continue to dream because you clearly have incredible insights in your dreams. John Benjamin is been called by many a bald asshole, and more because of their dealings with him when they were awake. So I would suggest to you, keep dreaming, and anything in your dream that would involve helping another or enriching yourself in some way, I would follow that. You seem to be on the verge of something big here. Morella, 622. Hey, Sam. Matthew says Benjamin is living the dream. Matthew knows him. Hey, Sam, there's been some speculation on the Blue Roots blog that you'd be a good candidate for the new pilot about a TV talk show host pattern on Keith Olbermann's career. You thinking of auditioning for the main character's role? You'd be perfect. That's an offer only, probably, for bigger stars. Look for, like, a Jason Bateman or someone like that. I'm not kidding. Yeah. Bateman's a good actor. That's where they'll start. That's where they'll start. Bateman was always the guy before Arrested Development. I think I probably beat Bateman out for one pilot at one point. I can't remember which one it was. And then he was always the guy who was like, there was always like two or three guys ahead of me, even when I was at my like peak. And Bateman was a guy we would go back and forth. And I went in on that Arrested Development. And they gave it to Bateman, of course. And then it was over. Then, you know, any pretense that I was hanging in there with him was completely... Because he's like me, but better looking and more charming and funnier. I don't know if he's funnier. Well, don't take so long to answer that question, Dorsey. You're trying to remember? Well, here's let me refresh your memory. I'm funnier. He's a little more charming, maybe a little better looking. But I got news for you. If his sister's name was Justine Cedar, I think we'd be seeing a different story right now. I should see if he'll call in. I used to be sort of friendly with him back in the day. Bush in chains. Gilad Osman, liberating the American people from AIPAC. Just like Communist China, U.S. installs statewide media, Al Jazeera censorship. Jimmy Carter, Mubarak will have to leave. French, U.K., banks are most at risk in Egypt. Brent crude is... Crude has just surpassed $100 for the first time since October 2008. Yeah, this is going to be expensive. Gas is going to go up, there's no doubt. I wish the U.S. had a place where all the libertarians could go and live without any government. Oh, yeah, Afghanistan. There you go. To Dramanthes, is this just Coffee Clatch with Sam Cedar? What do you think? Good end segment name? Right now I think it's just going to end up being... members only show, because that communicates that it's a show for members only. On his networks, do you remember interviewing Michael Hart on the old Majority Report on networks? His book Empire came up with the idea of multitude as the new subject of politics, which works much like networks. It seems multitude. I don't know. Did we interview him?
I've seen it in the rundown.
So oh, you have?
I've never listened to the interview, but I saw it in the rundown.
Let's look for that and pull it. Will you make a note of that?
Sure.
Kevin Semicolon. Juan Cole is okay, but you know who could really speak to this Egypt situation? Gallagher. That is a joke, because apparently Gallagher stormed out of Marin's WTF podcast. I know. And the thing is that everyone who's listening to me right now is going to download WTF for that. I know I am. Like... Optimal Tomatoes. Morning, Sam. You know, folks, we should do a thing like we're going to do maybe sometime next week. I want to see how long into the podcast people are listening. if people are listening, you know, this far into it. Maybe we should, we may need a survey soon.
Need some kind of code people email you with if they've listened this far.
Just a, like a, like a four-question survey.
Yeah.
Are you a member? You know, we will pick a day when we tell people to, you know, that type of thing. Sam, what do you think is the best case, worst case, Egypt's possible revolution on Israel? I can easily see Egypt's new government being fairly hostile and further isolating Israel. On the other hand, a more isolated Israel may feel enough heat to make significant progress toward a Palestinian state, though that's probably way too optimistic. I would be surprised if there is fundamental change with their relationship with Israel. I don't know that there is a real interest amongst Egyptians for this. I don't know what the Muslim Brotherhood stance is on it. But, you know, look, at the end of the day, you get, the important thing is that we give Egypt, whatever, $1.5 billion a year to the military. I mean, let me ask you this. If Cenk, the Young Turks, started paying Evan and Dorsey, you know, or like, hey, you need, you guys need new computers? Here's some new computers. Hey, you guys, you know how your brother-in-law works in that factory? You know, because the tanks that we pay for are made in Egypt. So all those people have jobs. And they're requisitioned by the army. I mean, so, you know, there's a whole infrastructure here. But it's like, hey, Dorsey, dollar lunch, huh? Hmm. Hey, how about we move the office to the $7 lunch district of Manhattan, and you guys get your lunches, and we're going to have a nicer office, and, you know, all new equipment and this and that. And, oh, Sam wants to do YouTube videos. That's sort of what the Young Turks does. Could you guys maybe sway that a little bit differently? And then all of a sudden, Dorsey's like tipping over the camera, and Evan's like, I can't get sound on your videos. I can only do it on your, you know, that's the way it would work. Kyle says he's only been offer only. Oh, yes, I see. Did I throw around a offer only? Did I throw around a showbiz?
Yeah, you did. You said that about being the fictional Keith Olbermann.
Oh, yeah. That, in other words, anybody who would audition for that part ain't going to get that part. It's going to go out to somebody who's already established. Man, you know, but I would go and audition for like a part-time job. That would be great. I would love to get any type of part-time show business work. Do this, get paid. I like it. Frisbane. Hi, Sam. Great show. I stream Al Jazeera English Saturday and Sunday. It was amazing to watch. I got concerned thinking about how Egypt access to the internet was cut off. I hope people are working on an alternate internet routing scheme to around such attempts to cut people off from the world. People are working on it. Super Funk. Yo, Sammy. Glenn Beck said everyone ripping on Michelle Bachmann's response to State of the Union is disgraceful and happening because she could run for president and win. Is there any chance we could be fortunate enough to see Bachmann run? Yes. Absolutely.
That would be amazing.
Absolutely. If Sarah Palin doesn't, I actually think Bachmann could be more dangerous in some respects than Sarah Palin. Just because she's, you know,
she's only spent the past year discrediting herself.
Yeah. She's a little bit underexposed. Only political junkies knows. And then if like she is, she could just be like completely reined in. Like she had a comment. I remember when she first got elected, like that it was about how her husband subjugated her properly. I can't remember exactly what it was in context of, but like, she definitely is like, you know, one father figure away from doing whatever that person says. And that's scary. Whereas Palin, you know, was like she had that sort of big fish in a small pond syndrome where she thought, like, I am nobody tells me what to do. She was just nakedly ambitious. Michelle Bachmann is like a real sort of crazy Christian, and they're programmable, I mean, by definition. I don't think she's as dumb as Sarah Palin. I think she's crazy and programmable. And those are the most dangerous people. Klug, 77th minute, still here. The tear gas canisters of ABC's Christian Poor was picking up in Cairo. They read in printed English, made in America. You know, here's a suggestion. If we're going to sell armaments to foreign countries to repress their own people, one, my first suggestion would be don't do it. Second suggestion, don't advertise.
Do we let them put Made in Egypt on the side of the tanks?
I mean, it's pretty... It's almost as if you would do that if you wanted not to be blamed to yourself. Like, if you wanted to sort of divert a little bit of anger. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. I wonder if people are watching Al Jazeera in lieu of IMing. It's possible. Well, we've got a bunch of IMers, but, I mean, it's... Look, I was just thinking of... You know, just playing that feed. But there is some domestic politics today. And, you know, I think for many people who are busy, they don't have the time to catch up to this. So I wanted today's show to basically be a primer. I think if you listen to today's program, you will have a basis in which to follow what takes place. Because I think a lot of people are still catching up. Mark Green says, I know I usually bust your balls on the IM, but you got me thinking today about Justin Bateman. He'd be a great host for the Majority Report. Better than you, probably. Think about it. Lauren was there when Mark Green, and he did this like in front of my staff. He's in the doorway between the studio and the producer's booth area. And he says, wait till you see who we have hired to replace you. I think you're really going to like them. And I just stood there and I was like, what? And I remember just like looking over to like Lauren, I think Rosen was in there, and they were just like, just their mouth agape. I mean... So dumb. So dumb. So weirdly dumb. Farmer Jillian, thank you for the Egypt update. Maybe rethink members only title. Because every time that ugly cropped leather jacket's coming by. Oh, right. Those member only jackets. What about Majority Report Extreme? Isn't that the that's the Glenn Beck one, right?
Oh yeah, no.
Insider. Maybe it should be something more blatant, like the Better Than the Rest of You show, for the truly developed only show. Insider Extreme. Saw Marin perform in Portland this weekend. He was extra specially agitated and hilarious. Must have been the Gallagher residual. Farmer Jillian, I want you to know that I did... I'm in the middle of the grape cloning. I don't know if it's working. I spilt the soil and I don't know. How do I know? How long do I give it? I was at a friend's house last night, says Tripp, and I saw some cable. We wanted to watch Portlandia, pretty good on IFC, but I was surprised to see they were airing Ben Stiller's show, Undeclared, Freaks and Geeks, Arrested Development, Cross, and Odenkirk. Sorry to go off topic. Sometimes I need an Egypt break. Yeah, no, absolutely. I didn't know they had Bob and Dave's show. But yeah, they're really heavily moved into that area. Chimp Evil 66. Hey, Sam, thanks for the instruction on how I am. I'm sorry about the past losing. No, I'm not a delirious joy being a Steelers fan anyway. I wanted to ask you, what gives us the fucking right to dictate to other countries the system of government they should have? Like, we have moral authority or something? Give me a break. We really have no right. I mean, it's simply law of the jungle in which we have influenced these people. But I agree with you. We don't have a right. I mean, I think that it's appropriate for us to use our military to stop ongoing genocide. And beyond that, I don't think there is any other use of our military in that regard. Peacekeeping forces, I could see, too. Spaff, are you sure Mark Green wasn't just that mean rather than dumb? It almost sounds like a power trip on his part. No. It was dumbness. He had no idea that what he was saying was in any way. He wanted to encourage me that I was that he thought that it was important to me to maintain the integrity of the network. Now, the irony is, maybe he was talking about somebody else and that person dropped out, but fucking Lionel? I went into him and I said, you realize this guy's not a liberal, that he has shat on your biggest star practically on the network at this point, Rachel. And the guy's not a liberal. To the extent that he's political, he considers himself a libertarian. He goes, well, Sam, we're still 70% liberal. And I mean, that's how I know it was stupidity. The guy was so fucking dumb. Like, what? Are you going to put that on a bumper sticker? Air America, still 70% liberal. Air America, we're as liberal as you can get 3/4 of the time. Just bizarre.
Neffer sent the article. Harold, Bateman and Oldman are baseball buddies, right? But you got the call up to fill in, not Jason. Well, that's right. But this is an actual acting show, not a... Sam, I sent you a t-shirt design that you can use to sell for extra cash flow. Oh, yes, I did see it. I got to go back and check it out. Yes, I did see it. I liked it. Cry Pop Phil. We listened to the show to hear the boys, not Lionel. Whoa, that's... You know who figured that out? Lionel. That's why he gets so angry. Hey, Sam, will you catch the Super Bowl and cheer for the Steelers' loss? I will be stealing for Steelers' loss, and I will probably watch it. Depends. I'm sure you interviewed Hart because I know him personally. I've only seen him interviewed on Majority Report. Charlie Rose has come out with 2 more books and a trilogy. Oh, Antonio Negri. I'll look it up. Maybe we'll have him back on. Kevin Semicolon. Do Evan and Dorsey have ranks, specific titles? Do they have individual personality traits? No, no, and no. Does one go by his last name or his first name? Dorsey. Dorsey. There you go. Klug. I feel you about 70% of the time. Saw Marin in Portland, too. Herbalez. Incredible pictures of the protests in Freedom Square. And Avant. Montel was a super liberal and a perfect addition to Air America lineup, but he was from Mark Green, though, right? I meant not from Mark Green. You're being facetious. Avant, but he was not from Mark Green. No, that was a joke. Only 30% deeply compromised. Earl, Cameron Bear, how did Break Room Live come about? It just seems sort of tenuous. I mean, you were broadcasting from a break room. That's for a different day, because it's time. Remind me, and I'll talk about that one day. Maybe when we get Marin on, if he ever will come on. But he's being... What's that? Were you writing me something? We're going to get Marin on. All right, folks. See you tomorrow. Please become a member. If you're still listening, you haven't become a member, you should. And buy some coffee. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made.